Lauren is a professor of integrative biology at the University of Texas at Austin. Can you give me, like, your Lauren, your estimate of R0 for this virus? In other words, do you see it as? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I can talk about it. I mean, so I don't know if your audience all knows what R0 is, but, you know, the reproduction number of the virus is, in short, the expected number of secondary cases that each infected person will cause, how many people you'll infect if you become infected. So so R0 is the not stands for a subscript zero, which is sort of what is the transmission rate or the reproduction rate of the virus in its native state when there's no interventions and when there, you know, really nobody's been infected yet. So if you are talking about R0, you're really talking about how was it spreading before we started to intervene. And our estimates for that range from 2 all the way up to 10, depending on where it was estimated, what method was being used, what data was being used. But I mean, the upshot is that before, if this thing is just sort of left to its own devices, the reproduction number is probably well above 2. But then what we're tracking on kind of more of a real-time basis is something we call just the reproduction number or the effective reproduction number, R sub T, R sub E. And that's sort of like what, you know, how fast is it actually spreading under today's conditions, and which will vary from city to city, depending on what kinds of interventions have been enacted, and also depending on how mature the epidemic is. The more people who have already been infected, the more immunity has been built up in the population, the slower the virus will spread. And so that really varies. So, for example, we're trying to estimate the reproduction number on almost a daily basis in Austin, Texas, where I live, working with local data. And our own local estimates were that the reproduction number was probably well above 3 in early March before we closed schools and went into a stay-home order. And then in kind of the depths of stay-home, when people really were sitting still and not going out, the reproduction number dropped safely below 1. So, and the reproduction number of 1 is sort of that threshold for where you, if it's below 1, you would expect the outbreak to sort of fizzle out on its own. If it's above 1, you know you can have exponential growth. And now, sort of week to week, things are starting to rebound. And right now, the estimated, like today, the estimated reproduction number is somewhere right about 1. It could be a little below, a little above, but we're just sort of at this precarious point where we could start to kind of move back into a phase where we would expect an imminent wave of the pandemic.
So things I don't understand, why was the transmission rate so low on those cruise ships and on that U.S. aircraft carrier where there was a COVID? Why, take that aircraft carrier in particular, it is highly dense. This living space is like mind-boggling. It's like 40x of a normal U.S. American home. Why didn't we see massive spread on the aircraft carrier?
So I have not studied that data closely, but my understanding is that the folks on the aircraft carrier were only on the aircraft carrier for, I mean, less than 2 weeks. And even though it's very dense, it was a huge population, right? Thousands of soldiers on that carrier, thousands of weight. And so it just, even if it, you know, spread almost like wildfire, it would just actually literally take several generations of transmission to get, you know, completely saturate that population. So I think given the amount of time that they were all sort of residing on the ship, probably with some efforts at least to quarantine, locally quarantine, even though there were a lot of people in one bunk, the number of cases over that short period of time isn't necessarily inconsistent with what we've estimated elsewhere for the transmission rate for the virus.
Why don't you go ahead and start, and I'll continue to send notes to everybody.
Okay.
I apologize.
Yeah. No problem. All right. You can all hear me. All right. Well, greetings from Austin. So I've been modeling pandemics for decades during threats like SARS, the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, the West African Ebola epidemic, Zika, and now COVID. We modelers seek answers to 3 basic questions. Where and how is the virus spreading today? What should we expect tomorrow and in the future? And how should we use costly or limited resources to slow spread and save lives? In other words, we model 1, to gain situational awareness, 2, to forecast, and 3, to support decision-making. So I'm going to start with the second objective, forecasting. We've built an online COVID death forecasting model that is now part of the CDC's ensemble. It was the first model to make forecasts for individual cities and to use cell phone geolocation data as an indicator of how much people are actually social distancing down to the census tract. Forecasting gets a ton of attention from policymakers, the press, the public, but it is fraught with difficulties. Without a crystal ball telling us how people and policymakers are going to behave or when new drugs and vaccines are going to come online, it's nearly impossible to project beyond a month. It's different from weather forecasting in two key ways. First, weather forecasting is a far more mature and highly resourced endeavor. It rests on centuries of R&D, several orders of magnitude more daily data, and 1,000-fold larger annual budget in the U.S. Relatively speaking, pandemic forecasting is brand new, and it's done on a shoestring. Second, our forecasts are often made to be broken. When they look bleak, we want them to change behavior, which then changes the forecast. When meteorologists forecast a hurricane, we know that there is nothing to do but get out of the way. If we forecast an unmanageable surge in COVID hospitalizations, we hope that steps will be taken to alter that fate. For these and many other reasons, people have a difficult time believing the forecast and behaving commensurately with the projected risk. Now back to the first pursuit, modeling to get a basic handle on the threat, particularly in the early days of emergence. Recall early January, the news out of China was unreliable and changing daily. Within 24 hours of COVID breaking the news, my team started to triangulate, scavenging for any data on the virus and the community in which it was spreading, and building new models that captured not only the spread of the virus, but also, and really importantly, the fuzzy lens through which we were seeing the situation. This is not just correcting for biases. This is thinking concretely about what we could and could not see happening in Wuhan at the time. In our first of several detective-like studies, we used the timing and location of the first 19 cases reported outside of China in Bangkok and Seattle elsewhere, combined with global air travel data and the cell phone mobility data from millions of people in China to essentially back out the exponential growth rate of the epidemic in Wuhan. We projected that by the time of the January 23rd lockdown, well over 10,000 people had been infected, which was far more than the 425 that were reported by China. So I'm going to pivot finally to the third and arguably the most valuable of our modeling efforts, where a lot of the action is today. And that's in designing robust mitigation strategies when weighing the costs and the benefits of myriad options is beyond the capacity of even the brightest mind. Sometimes this is about getting into the weeds. We've helped the federal government figure out when and where to release strategic national stockpile drugs, to help them figure out how many ventilators to pre-position in hospitals versus central stockpiles for future threats. But today, we are up in the trees. We're using models to articulate at the very highest level where we are and where we need to go in the months ahead. In a world of vague nods to 14-day declines and politicized wearing of face masks, policymakers urgently need clear guidance on what data to track and when to take action. So we are working with decision makers like the CDC and like Mayor Adler of Austin, who spoke on this call a couple weeks back, to clarify the goals of future policies. What do we hope to achieve? And the constraints of future policies, what will the law abide and what will the public abide, as well as which data to track to ensure we are on target. So here's where we are in Austin. We've designed a strategy to comply with the Texas governor's relaxation orders and to satisfy two goals. Goal number one, prevent surges in COVID hospitalizations that overwhelm our capacity and lead to many more severe complications and deaths in those who do not receive timely or safe care. And goal number two, minimize the duration of economically restrictive policies. After months of almost daily discussions between city leaders, all regional healthcare systems, and the modelers, we came up with a robust policy that is easy to state and it is practical to implement. And here it is. Okay, what we track on a daily basis is new COVID-19 hospital admissions. We're not tracking total hospitalizations, we're not tracking cases, we're not tracking deaths. This is our most reliable indicator of an impending surge in hospitalizations. Then, when the numbers exceed predetermined thresholds, we trigger changes in policy. Austin now has a five-colored alert system, ranging from full-blown stay home, the red, to very relaxed, green. It has clear triggers for toggling between the different colors that my team optimized so that Austin can proactively tap on the brakes to keep the surge manageable and to avert prolonged stay home orders going forward. Both online and in the press, the county judge, the mayor, other leaders have begun to socialize the idea that when Austin hits 20 new admissions per day, we're going to have to rein things in. This framework can be tailored to any city to reduce the need for strict orders while ensuring the integrity of the health system, the safety of the health workforce, and public confidence. But even if it's not, here's the takeaway. We need clarity on what to track and when to act. In New York and elsewhere, even after drastic actions were taken, hospitalizations and deaths continued to climb for weeks and even months before finally reaching their peak. So to navigate the road ahead, we should do the following. One, look at hospital admissions as a reliable indicator of changing risk. Two, enact staged measures to slow transmission before reaching the point of no return. And three, recognize that decisive action will be needed long before we approach local healthcare capacity. Thank you.